This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Books Uncovered, an exciting conversation about books and literary events, brought to you by the Dunedin Athenaeum Library and Mechanics Institute.
I'm Holly.
And I'm Bella.
Over the next half hour, we'll dive into themes ranging from romance to quirky book blurbs, all discovered within the depths of the Athenaeum Library. Kia ora, thanks for tuning in. I have Caitlin in the studio with me today. Kia ora, Caitlin.
Kia ora, Koto. It's not Bella today, it's Caitlin.
Yeah, Bella's on holiday again, lucky. It's actually proper summer now. It's that I always feel so sorry for school students who go back to school and then it becomes summer in Dunedin.
I remember that feeling.
Anyway, today we have an exciting... So last time I had you on, Caitlin, we were talking about what maketh the classic.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're sort of going in that vein again, and we're talking about dystopian novels today.
Yeah, focusing on the dystopian classics.
So we've brought in three titles that everyone will be familiar with. But shall we have a wee chat about what defines a novel as dystopian?
Yeah, well... From my understanding, the history of dystopian literature is traced back to the French Revolution in 1789 and a reaction to that. And this whole idea that mob rule would produce dictatorship. And it's kind of often got this anti-collectivist feeling to it, which is really evident in books like 1984 and Brave New World. It kind of comes across in these kind of classic 20th century dystopian books. It's almost got like a anti-communist vibe, wouldn't you say, often?
Yeah, I guess so, because there is one leader, usually. Yeah. I saw that it was dystopia offers the opposite, the portrayal of a setting that completely disagrees with the author's ethos. But it's a sub-genre, isn't it, as well?
And it can also be very linked in with sort of sci-fi. And we've got like this, the dystopian books, which are really close to our own world and just have like a little twist which make things different, and we can really relate to it. And then we've got ones which are totally foreign.
I mean, certainly, yeah, I do feel like you find them in the sci-fi fantasy section. Although I was thinking about Paul Lynch's new book, The Prophet, which is...
Prophet Song.
The Prophet Song. And because that's a contemporary book, I don't think you would find that in sci-fi, though, would you?
Oh, it's definitely not sci-fi. There's nothing science about it, in my opinion. And is it even dystopian? It's more speculative.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, this whole concept of what if, but without that kind of space age technology, that technological aspect.
Mm.
So
you're born in a classic today.
I have an absolute classic. Let's talk about 1984. I mean, I feel like this is a book that... if you haven't read about it, you know about it. Like, it has...
That is very true.
There are all these terms which you might not even know come from the book, like thought police and thought crime and doublethink and, like, the idea of, like, 2 + 2 = 5 and, like, even the term Orwellian.
So remind us of when this was published.
Okay, so it was published in... 1948, so that's like an inversion of 84. There are some theories about why that date was chosen. One of them is that it was just an inversion, and then there's some other ideas as well, which I can't quite remember.
So post-war.
Post-war.
Written in England.
Yeah. Written in England. Okay, so it centres on, like, totalitarianism with Big Brother, who's in charge, mass surveillance and a repressive regimentation of people and behaviour. In it, there's these three superpowers, Oceania, Eurasia and East Asia, all fighting each other in a perpetual war. But like who is fighting each other is constantly changing. Like the narrative is changing, and our protagonist Winston Smith is working for the newspaper and changing the news. He's kind of he's rewriting history and throwing the old news down like a memory hole. And well, that's the truth now. I mean, it's so relevant today with like false news.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, at one stage, somebody is giving a talk, like making an official announcement, and the facts change halfway through, and who's fighting who suddenly changes, and he just like goes on without missing a beat, and nobody even notices.
Incredible.
So it's really, really bleak. Everything is censored. They have something called Hate Week. There's no privacy in their houses.
Hate Week.
Yeah.
Wow. It's been a long time since I read this novel.
Me too.
Yeah, I think I must have read it in my early 20s.
But I loved it. I thought it was incredible.
Something I want to return to.
Mm-hmm. The city is in ruins. There's social decay. You know, like a broken window can go 2 years in an apartment without being fixed. And they're drinking this terrible, nasty drink, Victory Gin, which is like a play on the Victory cigarettes that British people were smoking in India, because, like, you know, Orwell has this like, he was born in
Burma,
wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
But the proles kind of have free thought. He's living in this middle-class world, but when you go down into the slums, the proles are kind of rebelling against everything, and they're like these little rats on the underground. And he begins this love affair with someone in his office, which is very, very frowned upon. He's caught. There's this utterly terrible scene. Yep. End of the day. Doesn't work out. There's this terrible torture scene with like a cage put over his head with a rat in it.
Oh, wow.
And he like denounces his love and he pledges allegiance to the party. Originally, it was one of his publishers wanted to bill it as like a thriller mixed up with a love story. And he was just like, oh, hell no. But, you know, I guess it kind of is when you look at it from like another perspective. really, really bleak. What somebody says to Winston at one point, if you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
Oh, gosh, that's so bleak.
It became really popular in the inner circles in Russia at the time, or was it the USSR?
I'm not
it
sure.
It must have been the USSR.
Yeah.
You know, it was a forbidden book, and they'd pass it round between each other and be like, oh, my gosh, how are they're amazed that a writer who never lived in Russia should have such a keen perception into this life.
Yeah. It's sort of... It became a lot, like I used to work in this secondhand bookshop in London, and when Trump got in, like the first time, the sale of this book just increased. We used to sell one copy every day of it. I think that's quite amazing. It was the most popular book
that
in the whole
so
shop.
That is so interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when I'm listening to the news coming out of America at the moment with like immigration and abortion and just absolutely everything, I'm like, oh my God, it's like a... You know, it's like a frog in a boiling a frog.
I find it fascinating as well that these writers had the foresight for this as well. Like you said, he wrote 1984 and in
1948.
Because, yeah, I'm going to be talking about Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, which was published in 1953.
Mm.
And it's incredible what a grasp of today they have, actually.
Know.
Like, it's quite utterly disturbing. And these writers used to sort of, like, H.G. Wells used to, I can't remember who was the Prime Minister at the time when he was living in England, but the Prime Minister used to talk to H.G. Wells because he had a foresight for society in this way. Like, actually, people who could contain the world.
It's, you know, because they're looking at their own society and they're seeing the rot within it, and they're extrapolating and being like, what will happen if this keeps going?
Yeah.
Taking it to its furthest degree.
Well, shall I have a...
Yeah, I'd love to. Okay. I'd love to hear about Fahrenheit 451.
Well, it's been one of those books, you know, you're like, oh, I need to read that. I haven't, for some reason, I missed reading it at some point.
Me too. I only read it a couple of years ago.
Yeah, well, I came across this video. It was done for Channel 4 in the UK about these librarians that were banning together, no pun intended, about banned books in libraries in America. And, Fahrenheit 451 was on it. And I was like, oh, I still haven't read that novel. I need to read it. And then I found it at the Athenaeum, who bring you the show. And it's a really slight book. It's really small. It's in three parts. As I said before, it's published in 1953. And so it's a imagining of a dystopian American future. It's devoid of individuality, empathy, intellectual nourishment and freedom. What I found, it's about a guy called Guy Montag, and he's a fireman. But firemen, their jobs aren't to put out fires, they're to start them and they're to burn books. And he's third generation fireman. And he lives with his wife, and they have these parlors. Everyone has these parlors in their house, and it's basically a room that has four complete screens as the walls, excepting, you know, they're still saving up for their fourth screen. They've only got three. So it's really a nod to how absorbed people are with their screens, which is utterly fascinating. So books are sort of seen as like antagonistic, and that they divide people, and everyone's just kind of pleasure seeking, and it's just the pursuit of entertainment. But they're also really disconnected from themselves. Like, there's one point where Guy, the main protagonist, asks his wife, like, when did we meet? They've been together for 10 years and they both can't recall when they met.
There are such similarities here with 1984. You know, 1984 has the telescreen and the revision of truth kind of losing its salience as well.
Like, they, in this world, the architects took off porches from people's houses and gardens because they didn't want to sort of encourage people to sit there and think or talk to each other. So there's this real like disconnect from everyone, and it's like really isolating. But basically one day Guy meets this young girl, and she's quite old and is making observations about sort of nature, and he's sort of starting to get like restless, these sort of inklings. And basically, I mean, I don't want to give away what happens, but
I gave it away. Good on you, Holly. I respect that.
So Montag, I think, was like a publishing press at the time, and he meets a man called Faber, which we all know is Faber Printing House. And so Faber's a bit of a meek man, but he, you know, he's also against the system, and he used to be an academic. And there's all these academics that live on the outskirts of town, you know, and huddle by fires and
under a bridge.
Yeah, under a bridge. So when he meets Faber, Faber says to Guy, "I don't talk things, sir. I talk the meaning of things. I sit here and know I'm alive," because there's sort of this constant prattle of noise. Like his wife talking to herself, and the noise, like everyone has like an earpiece, so they're just constantly entertained, distracted. There's no moment to stop and think about, why am I alive, or why is this like this?
And it was written in 1953, right?
1953.
So when we think about like the role that television played in lives at the time, like it was...
And it was kind of during that like medicated sort of suburban
Valium housewives.
Yeah. So it's, I definitely think that's kind of talking to it as well. He was writing this in the 40s. I mean, obviously because of when it's written, it's not without flaws. You know, like women aren't really seen in a good light, and all the characters, I mean, yeah, are men. You're a bit like, oh, okay, it's bound to have a little bit of that. And actually some of the dialogue's really, really clumsy, and I don't know if that's intentional or to sort of reiterate that people, because they're not reading and having conversations with each other, aren't able to, like, articulate themselves very well. Like, they're quite short sentences. Because I saw one review about that being like, oh, some of the dialogue. And it's like, I'm pretty sure this is intentional, though.
That's interesting. That's an interesting way of thinking of it. Because I was quite surprised when I read it, at like how I didn't think it was particularly well written. I thought the themes were marvelous. Mm. But I was kind of like, ugh.
Yeah, because it's one of his earlier books. This edition that we've got at the Athenaeum has a really interesting little prologue from the author talking about his time writing this when he was at the University of California. He used to go to the library there and write it to get away from his family. And he called it a dime book because he had to put money in to use the typewriter as kind of a, yeah, you'd get a certain amount of time to put the money in.
Okay, so that is where the phrase of like dime store books come from.
I thought
it meant that the books cost a dime.
Well, not in the making. Well, yeah. In the typing.
Okay.
Interesting. Yeah. Huh. Anyway, I really, really enjoyed this novel. I think, yeah, I was happy with where it led to. I was thinking about it when I wasn't reading it. I think it's a really important book to engage with, especially in the climate that we're living. Yeah, for me, it was just like, oh, this just speaks so much to how absorbed we are by our computers and our telephones and, you know, and this constant, like, need to sort of be entertained. We can't just sit at the bus stop and look out at the world. We need to be on our phone.
Well, I mean, I sit at the bus stop and read a book, so, I mean.
Yeah, but that's not being bombarded with different images and sounds, which is kind of what this is sort of speaking to, is, like, there's just so much noise.
Mm.
And there's these really scary mechanical dogs called the Hound, which are pretty cool, which is also a nod to, I'm going to not remember that one, but it's a nod to another Arthur Conan Doyle. I think there's like a hound in one of his stories.
The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Yes, it's a nod to that.
Yeah. Oh,
good. Well done. So what's the third book you brought in?
Well, I'm talking about Clockwork Orange. I mean, I'm sure that a lot of you...
The film.
And you picture that, like, those amazing images. God, it was a great film.
I'd actually like to watch it again. I mean, it's kind of horrendous, but yeah.
And the book is wonderful too. I really recommend it. It was written in 1962 by Anthony Burgess, written in just 3 weeks.
So we're going through the ages here. We started 48, 53.
You know, I think he sees it as like juvenilia. At the end, he, like in later life, he kind of was like, ugh, it was too didactic to be artistic. And he was kind of nauseated by the violence that he had written. So it was written during a time when England was gripped with fears of juvenile delinquency.
Like
harking back to Brighton Rock, I guess it was that kind of era. Like he wrote it in Hull, a little seaside town, I believe. And
he makes me think of Fiona Kidman's Mortal Boy.
Ah, yeah. You know, I still need to read that.
Yeah.
Do you have that in the Athenaeum, Holly?
We do.
Maybe I'll come by afterwards and grab it.
Very good book. Yeah.
Okay, so our protagonist is Alex. He's very clever and sharp. He has like his team of droogs who are into ultraviolence, and they gather in a bar and they drink something called Milk Plus, milk with like a little, with another drug added to it. It's like Our World, but with a twist. They speak this kind of talk called Ned Sat, which is so much fun to read.
But could be very off-putting.
Yeah, it depends what you're into. Nedsat is like a suffix, a Russian suffix, which means teen, like how we have like 13, 14, 15. So I think he's sort of trying to say that this is like teen speak, that the adults aren't really in on. He wanted his narrator to have a unique voice that would remain ageless and not date the book. He didn't want to use, like, the slang of his time. And I think that's worked really well.
I wonder what the slang of his time would have been. I mean, interest. But yeah, that's
the 60s, right? Everything was...
groovy.
Groovy. What's like the opposite of groovy? Okay, so I'm going to tell you about some of the Ned Sat. Like, there's little, like, simple things, like, Bog as God, and his drugs, his like followers, is derived from a Welsh word which means bad or naughty, and it's mixed with a Russian word which means close friends. So it's your naughty, bad, close friends. Oh, I just love it.
That's wonderful.
And then like to pony is to understand, and that's from a Russian word meaning ponymat, to understand. And the word for good is horosho. Oh, that's really horosho. And that's from a Russian word, korosho, which means good.
So is it spelt like horosho?
Yeah, in the book it's spelt horosho. I feel like so many of these words have... He's done such a good job of kind of making them make sense. Like you don't, like...
Like it's a natural...
It feels very natural, yeah, for someone like Alex to be like, if something's good, it's horror show, because he's into ultraviolence. And like your head is your Gulliver, which is... Oh, no, it's your Gulliver, sorry. Your Gulliver. Use your Gulliver. But that comes from a Russian word, Gulliver, which is here. I'm so sorry for saying that wrong to all you Russian speakers out there.
So is a lot of it derived from Russian?
Yes, yes, again, and that's that whole, you know, the obsessions of the time. Russia loomed large in people's imaginations. Mm. You know, it was,
does.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, that whole dystopian thing. Russia is the other.
Yeah.
Anyway, he is, kills a woman, sentenced to 14 years in prison, and undergoes an experimental, deeply dystopian behavior modification called the Ludovico technique. And it's a form of aversion therapy in which he's injected with nausea-inducing drugs while watching ultraviolence. And it causes him to become severely ill at the thought of it. And meanwhile, he's also listening to his beloved Beethoven while this is happening. And now he can, like, after the treatment, he can no longer listen to Beethoven, which is tragic.
How true to the book is the film?
Well, the book... has a couple of versions, and in one of them, there's kind of a redemption arc for Alex, and he ends up, you know, feeling really guilty, tries to kill himself, the process is kind of undone, ends on a positive note. I'm not sure exactly how much is left off in the film, but yeah, this Stanley Kubrick was just like, no way. And also the American version of the book has this positive redemption arc cut from the end too. And the publishers were like, no, the American audience will not go for this. They want it brutal.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I've not read Clockwork Orange, but I've seen the film. But a long time ago, again.
Mm, mm.
So it's dystopian in its, like, approach to...
Yeah, I mean, well, some people argue that it's more of a philosophical novel with dystopian elements than a conventional dystopia, because it's very moralistic.
Mm.
But, you know, we've got societal breakdown with violence, crime and moral decay, law enforcement struggling to maintain order. We've got oppressive state control with this Ludovico technique, with the state imposing a moral framework, and the dehumanization of Alex. He's like an object to be fixed rather than a person with moral agency. So it's not...
It ticks the boxes.
It ticks some of the boxes, you know, yeah.
Yeah, cool.
And I just want to quickly mention, because we don't have much time, oh my God, Brave New World. I kind of wanted to talk about that, but I remember they didn't remember it well enough.
Yeah, I read that probably 10 years ago, so it's a bit fresher in my mind than, say, 1984. I just remember the end scene and being quite...
I don't remember anything, but I loved it.
It was interesting because he was living in California and he wrote that. I don't think I can talk about what he was doing there, but let's just say it was a bit risky. An interesting lifestyle.
Yeah.
Swingers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's a utopia, you know, like a pseudo-utopia that turns out to be dystopian. And I highly recommend that to our listeners. Like, I remember just being like, oh, this is like glorious junk food. And my friend watching me read it was like, I am so jealous of you reading that for the first time. I wish I could read that for the first time again.
I think it's really important to revisit these classics. I mean, because I work, I'm the head librarian at the Athenaeum, I'm lucky I have access to brand new books all the time. But yeah, I find it's really lovely to like actually pull something from the depths and revisit them, especially, yeah, when they're like famous for a reason books that have quite, you know, they have something to say about the society that we live in, especially if they've been written from such a long time ago.
Absolutely.
And still speak.
And I feel like people often know a lot about these books and feel like they don't need to bother reading them because, you know, oh, 1984, I know exactly what that's going to be like.
I'm pretty sure there's a re-edition TV for Brave New World as well.
A couple of years back,
there was like a mini-series.
Mm.
Definitely saw that.
Yeah.
We've run out of time. It's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. And I'm sure we'll do another one of these. We're like, what can we do as another classic subgenre of the classic? But until then, have a great week, everyone. Cheers, Caitlin.
Cheers.
Books Uncovered. Exciting conversations about books and literary events. Brought to you by the Dunedin Athenaeum Library and Mechanics Institute.
Join us, Holly and Bella, every second Saturday at 12 p.m. as we dive into themes ranging from romance to quirky book blurbs, all discovered within the depths of the Athenaeum Library.
That's Books Uncovered.
Saturdays at 12 on ORFM and online at oar.org.nz.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.